Lecture 83, Clinton's America and the Millennium.
In the last lecture, we looked at some of the foreign policy issues of the 1990s and the continuing anxieties confronting American policymakers around the world. Let's look this time at the man who presided over American domestic life in the 1990s, Bill Clinton, a man who certainly intended that his impact on American life would primarily be domestic. He surrendered much of the Democratic Party's liberal heritage and presented himself as a vigorous pro-business president. His 8-year administration witnessed an incredible period of economic growth in America, but also a continued growth in the gap between the richest and the poorest Americans. The decision to dismantle many of Lyndon Johnson's great society programs, notably aid to families with dependent children, which had been a center of the welfare policy, and Clinton's failure to create a national health care system, underlined the difference between America and the other Western nations, which by the 1990s had lavish cradle-to-grave welfare states. Under greater media scrutiny than any predecessor, Clinton was severely embarrassed, first by Whitewater, and then much worse by the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But he was able to survive impeachment and trial. Meanwhile, continued turbulence in the Middle East, which generations of policymakers had been powerless to quiet, with really the lone exception of President Carter's Camp David peace accord between Israel and Egypt, made America a devil nation to large parts of the Muslim world. This judgment confronted America in the starkest possible way in September 2001 with the Al-Qaeda attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Well, President Clinton, I mean, like every president, in so many ways an intriguing and controversial figure, a man with great skills on the one hand, but ruinous weaknesses on the other. I think that was a theme in my description of President Nixon, and he could certainly say the same of Clinton as well. Coming from Arkansas, through his intellectual skills, he was able to lead a highly distinguished educational career in college at Georgetown, then as a Rhodes Scholar, one of the most prestigious international fellowships at University College Oxford, and then going on to Yale Law School, where he met and married the most successful woman in the class, Hillary Rodham. He was very, very hardworking, an incredibly gifted political campaigner, with the result that by the age of 32, he'd become the governor of the state of Arkansas, then he was the youngest governor in the nation. He was a brilliant campaigner, very, very good at remembering names. Apparently, eventually, he knew the name of most of the people in Arkansas. Having once met someone and shaken hands with them, he'd never forget who they were. And, of course, that's a great skill when you go back to the state, have a chance encounter with someone and know exactly who they are. Clinton also had a reputation for being able to empathize marvelously with the people he met, so that as people described their troubles and problems to him, he'd nod in agreement and seem smitten with the same woes that they suffered. And in fact, it became standard wisdom in Washington in the 90s that everybody who went to see Clinton left thinking that Clinton agreed exactly with their point of view on the question. Of course, since he agreed with each person in turn, including the holders of very, very different points of view, you couldn't be sure after the fact whether you had got his agreement as much as you hoped. Two of his great weaknesses were, well, first that he'd avoided the draft in the Vietnam War. At the time, it had seemed like an eminently reasonable thing to do. But in the slightly more culturally conservative mood of the 1990s, that was potentially a liability. After all, the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And if he has a reputation for avoiding his country's call at the vital moment, that undermines his credibility in dealing with military affairs. The other rumor, which was very well substantiated, was that he was a philanderer, that he couldn't resist having sexual affairs every time the opportunity presented itself. So, both strengths and weaknesses. And he was a surprise Democratic favorite for the presidential nomination in the election of 1992. The expectation, the orthodox view at the beginning of 1992 was that George Bush I was going to win re-election because he'd just won a war, the Gulf War, and there's almost no surer way of ensuring your popularity. But actually what happened is that America very rapidly went into an economic recession in 1992, so that the aura which had surrounded George Bush for his victory in the Gulf War began to dissipate in the ugly economic realities of 1992 inside the country. Also, he promised that he would impose no new taxes. In one famous speech, he said, "Read my lips." No new, in other words, I'm so serious about this. Nothing could deter me from this policy. But then he did raise taxes, a very, very politically unpopular thing to do, even if it might have been fiscally responsible. James Carville, who was one of the organizers of the Clinton campaign, actually had a sign stuck up in the election campaign headquarters, which said, "It's the economy, stupid." In other words, let's harp on that point. Let's keep on referring back to economic conditions and make the claim that Bush has caused this recession. And that way, our candidate, Clinton, will win. Many potential strong Democratic candidates decided not to run that year because they'd thought that Bush was a sure winner. And that had opened up an opportunity for Clinton to exploit, which he did very, very effectively. There was also a third candidate in the election of 1992, Ross Perot, a quixotic millionaire who was able to profit by taking advantage of voters' indignation over the political system in general. Politics in the 80s and 90s was bitterly contested, and members of the parties hated one another. Negative campaigning was more and more virulent, so that by watching TV ads before any election, you could believe that both candidates were hideous because of the horrible things said about them by the other. Well, Ross Perot, with his millions, entered the race with a big splash. Got a lot of enthusiastic support from the voters. But then, as so often happens, as journalists began to explore his life and his belief and his principles, found that he was, to say the least, a little bit nutty, with the result that he withdrew from the race in a crucial period in the fall leading up to the election, but then jumped back into it again in time for the presidential debates in which he joined. He probably took more votes away from Bush than he took away from Clinton. In fact, he scored 19 million votes, not enough to win, but the biggest showing by a third-party candidate in the whole of American history, even bigger than George Wallace had back in 68. It showed the voters' annoyance and cynicism rather than their genuine support for what he had to offer. Anyway, the upshot of the election was that Clinton became president. His honeymoon with Congress didn't last very long because straight away he started to push two policies, both of which were highly controversial. One was that openly gay people should be allowed to join and serve in the military, trying to displace the don't ask, don't tell policy which the Army had followed until then. And second, he attempted to introduce a national health care system. The person who was put in charge of the task force to bring about this revolutionary proposition was the First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, a very, very gifted graduate of Yale Law School. But although she was politically gifted in some ways, she certainly wasn't the most tactful. Sometimes she could be shrill in her confrontation with opponents. She was very combative and wasn't particularly successful in building up the necessary political coalitions to overcome the institutional resistance which a plan of this kind was necessarily going to generate. It wasn't long before she faced the opposition of the American Medical Association, the doctors' union, the insurance companies, the pharmaceutical companies, and the Republican Party. And that's too many adversaries to face. She should have done more to conciliate them if this plan was going to take place. But the result was that the scheme for a national healthcare system failed and was really one of Clinton's greatest legislative failures. The result was that America, astonishingly, ended the 20th century still without what had become a basic citizen's right in all the other countries of the developed world. It's one of the many areas of American exceptionalism. And it's also one of the areas where American inequality is most clearly visible. American healthcare is the best in the world for those who can afford it. But of course, millions can't, and millions have no proper health insurance at all. That means that medical research opportunities aren't geared to resolving the commonest medical complaints. They're geared to resolving the sufferings of people who can afford to pay for them. You know, rich people's illnesses are the ones which get the lion's share of the attention because they're clearly going to be a paying proposition. I mentioned in talking about the First World War, and then mentioned again in talking about the Second World War, that the army draft in both wars showed a shocking prevalence of poor health because of lack of basic health maintenance, right through to the end of the 20th century, that still persisted. Although it was now only about, well, only, it's a large percentage, 20 or 25% of the population, still lots of people didn't have necessary basic health care. Strangely anomalous, too, that those who did have it usually had it attached to their jobs, which, of course, tended to retard people's willingness to move from one job to another, because if they had a pre-existing condition, the health plan of the new employer wouldn't pick up their employment. So it tended to freeze people in place in certain types of employment. Well, dislike of Clinton, despite an improvement in the economy, led to a great Republican victory in the midterm elections of 1994. For the first time since 1952, suddenly, the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. And their leader was a Georgia congressman called Newt Gingrich, who promised what he called the contract with America. This was a plan to balance the federal budget, to introduce term limitations for politicians to prevent them from becoming permanent fixtures of the Washington scene, and improved ethics on Capitol Hill. And Gingrich had already made a name for himself by exposing various corruption scandals on Capitol Hill. But Gingrich, like various other politicians we've glanced at in the course already, people like James Watt, lacked a give and take of political life. He was too confrontational. He didn't understand that usually you've got to get to your objective through a very circuitous route by building up alliances. A little bit the same problem on the Republican side that Hillary Clinton had on the Democratic side. He found it very hard in practice to make way, and particularly difficult to carry out this everlasting Republican project of shrinking the federal government. Every Republican president says he's going to do it, and everyone runs into the fact that it's defended with incredible tenacity by people who are going to lose their jobs if it really does shrink. The most dramatic manifestation of this plan was that in the face of Democratic reluctance to cooperate with the idea, they closed the federal government down altogether, briefly in December 95 and again in January 1996, hoping to be able to make the case. It was Democratic intransigence, and it was the president's stubbornness which led to us being forced to close the government down. In fact, the blame went the other way. Popular opinion polls overwhelmingly said, this is an example of sheer recklessness on the part of Gingrich and the Republicans. They can't do this because an entire massive sector of the American economy is being artificially persecuted. This is the beginning of an election year, 96, when Clinton is running for re-election. By 96, the economy was in high gear and was roaring along rapidly. And the fact that Clinton could win, although he was already widely disliked and mistrusted by many electors, was a sign that very often it really is the economy which counts most. And strangely, although the Republicans had got a lot of vivid personalities whom they might have run for president, in fact, they chose one of the dullest of all the Republicans, Bob Dole, who lost handsomely in the election of 1996. Clinton's second administration was hamstrung by the Lewinsky affair. Now, he and Hillary Clinton had already been under investigation for their involvement in a fraudulent investment opportunity in Arkansas called the Whitewater Affair. Kenneth Starr, who'd been Solicitor General under the first President George Bush, was a special prosecutor investigating what had happened in the Whitewater scandal. It's a very, very complicated affair linked to the collapse of many savings and loan organizations in the late 80s. But although it was clear that some of Clinton's money had been involved in contaminated schemes, there wasn't what the prosecutors called a smoking gun to prove that he'd knowingly defrauded anybody. But more serious allegations were on the horizon. One was the claims by an Arkansas woman called Paula Jones that she'd been sexually harassed by Clinton when he'd been the governor. While that case was under investigation, he started a very rash sexual affair with a White House intern called Monica Lewinsky. He had a very vivid reputation for womanizing in Arkansas and even for getting the cooperation of the state police to help arrange his trysts and get him to them on time. Now, Monica Lewinsky herself, who was in her early 20s, talked to her friends about her affair with the president. And of course, this began to create leaks to the press because her friends passed on the news. She'd promised Clinton that she'd keep quiet about it all. But in fact, once her friends knew, of course, the cat was out of the bag. As soon as Republican politicians heard about this, they were delighted because they understood that this gave them the ideal leverage to embarrass and humiliate the president. Clinton lied about the affair. He lied about it in public on Capitol Hill and on television. And eventually it led to his impeachment. Eventually, when the evidence had accumulated, proving beyond any reasonable doubt that this affair had been going on, he did make a short TV speech on August the 17th, 1998, admitting to it and admitting that it was foolish to have done so. That December, he was impeached for lying under oath and then for trying to get others to lie on his behalf. And the charges were of perjury and obstruction of justice. It was a strange period because in order to make sense of what had happened at all, it became absolutely necessary for the media to describe what had been going on. So for the first time, the TV network news included frank and explicit accounts of oral sex, things which until then a veil had been drawn over in public life. Well, despite the scandal, the fact that America was still enjoying a period of immense economic buoyancy and the perception that the impeachment was really politically motivated in the partisan sense led, first of all, to a narrow Democratic victory in the midterm elections of 1998 and eventually to Clinton's not being convicted in the impeachment case itself. Democratic support in Congress and some Republican crossover votes enabled him to win acquittal, despite evidence of his improper conduct. In other words, it was difficult to claim that vital national interests were, in fact, at stake in this incident. Here's Senator Joseph Biden summarizing the case as a whole. Quote, "There are no good guys in this sordid affair. Rightly or wrongly, the public has concluded that the president is an adulterer and a liar. That Ken Starr has abused his authority by unfair tactics born out of vindictiveness. That the House managers have acted in a narrowly partisan way and are now desperately attempting to justify their actions for their own political reputation. Finally, they've concluded that Monica Lewinsky was both used and a user. While Linda Tripp, Lucianne Goldberg, Paula Jones, and her official and unofficial legal team are part of a larger political plot to get the president." In other words, it was easy to make to show connections between the women who were accusing Clinton and the Republicans who were trying to manipulate them to embarrass Clinton as much as possible. Well, ironically, Joseph Biden, who's making this case, already knew something about political scandals. He himself had earlier been running for president and had been forced to stop when it was discovered that one of the speeches he'd made, alleging that his own childhood had been very hard, had actually been borrowed from an English politician's speech making the same case. So, we've all got feet of clay and little human imperfections of various magnitudes are common on Capitol Hill as elsewhere. George Bush II won the election of the year 2000, running against Al Gore, who was Clinton's vice president. But George Bush only won after a recount of the votes in Florida, where the election appeared to be very, very close, and where Bush's brother was the state governor. The ballot itself had been confusing, and this is another case where intense news scrutiny is brought to bear on what looks like a very, very small point. But the way in which the ballot had been laid out apparently confused many Florida voters, so that they voted for one candidate in the belief that they'd been voting for another. Sometimes, in attempting to make perforations of the ballot, they hadn't quite made it through, with the result that little bits of paper were hanging loose, the so-called hanging chads. And again, the minutiae of this electoral machinery came to represent at a micro level the massive issue of who, in fact, was going to be the next president of the United States. Al Gore, like Bob Dole, actually, was rather stiff and wooden and not a very convincing candidate. Again, surprising that, in view of all the brilliant personalities in politics in the 90s, he, like Dole, should have been the outcome of the choice. Dull, awkward, and not particularly convincing. Well, the sustained boom of the 90s did nothing to narrow the gap between America's richest and poorest citizens. The high technology revolution of the 80s and 90s created a new generation of entrepreneurial wizards who gained almost the same social prestige that the brilliant entrepreneurs of the 1860s and 70s, people like Rockefeller and Carnegie, had had more than 100 years previously. The boom in the internet in the 1990s enabled numerous businesses to go online. And sometimes before the internet was quite ready for it. In the early days, a lot of credit card frauds were reported as people would give their credit card number and find it had been stolen from online. Delays for users because their machinery wasn't quite good enough. And the exaggeration of the prospects of the internet with the result that something of a bubble formed, exaggeratedly high share prices and so on. Still, the development of the technology was real enough, and people like Bill Gates, the mastermind of the Microsoft Corporation, became boundlessly wealthy. Gates was probably the richest man in the world by the end of the century. And the technology they were developing, although sometimes it led to false starts and to early failures, nevertheless would clearly have lasting benefits. Improvements in miniaturization of computers, increases in their speed, and also the rapid fall in the price of each new technology meant that it was being brought into the hands of more and more people. Andrew Carnegie had said that capitalism was all about turning luxuries into necessities, and the computerization of American business bore that out. In the early 80s, to have a computer was a luxury. By the year 2000, every business had got one, and you couldn't possibly do without it. This was, the 90s was also the decade in which a great plague of cell phones spread across America, at first a luxury item, also seemingly indispensable to judge by the frequency of their use by the early 21st century. Now, the great disappointment of the 90s was the failure of the war on poverty. Ever since the 1960s, the American government had as one of its objectives the elimination of American poverty, and yet it hadn't happened. In fact, there was a nagging disparity between the richest and the poorest Americans getting greater. And a constant 15 or 20% of the American people who continued to live below the poverty line, despite the fact that an immense array of programs had been designed explicitly to prevent that from happening. Finally, that led to a generation of welfare reform in legislation of 1996. Between the 60s, when the legislation had first been passed, and the 90s, the illegitimacy rate had increased very, very sharply, particularly among poor people. There had been a strong taboo against giving birth to a child out of wedlock prior to 1960. The taboo had been weakest among the poorest Americans, and it continued to get weaker very, very rapidly, with the result that more than half of poor children were born to single-parent families, in other words, born just to a mother, which in turn intensified the problem called the feminization of poverty, the fact that female-headed households were very, very vulnerable to poverty. Sociologists now argued that there was a permanent underclass in American life whose values and whose cultural approach to their dilemma made it very, very difficult that they could climb out of poverty. One of the most influential policy books of this era was Losing Ground by Charles Murray, who, after investigating all the statistics of poverty between the 60s and the late 80s, made this dramatic conclusion. If there had never been a war on poverty at all, and if the federal government had spent not a penny on poverty alleviation, we'd have less poverty now than we do. In other words, the unforeseen side effect, the unforeseen consequence of the war on poverty was to perpetuate it. And that many programs, he argued, had the effect of perpetuating poverty. For example, aid to families with dependent children gave an incentive to women to not marry, because by doing so, they'd lose their eligibility for this welfare benefit. Now, clearly, the intention of the legislation had not been to increase illegitimacy. It was one of the unforeseen side effects, such as bold policies always have. In the 90s, Charles Murray, who was a fearless, combative, neoconservative intellectual, co-authored another book called The Bell Curve, in which he said, one of the factors we have to take into consideration in looking at the different achievements of different groups in America is the fact that there are genetic differences in intelligence. And one of his most controversial conclusions was that as a whole, the African-American population was genetically less intelligent than the white population as a whole. That, of course, set off a great storm of controversy in policy and intellectual circles. Genetic arguments of this kind had been completely out of fashion for most of the 20th century. Instead, cultural arguments had dominated the ground. But in the 90s, genetic arguments started to come back in various ways. For example, gay rights advocates in some cases said there's a genetic disposition to homosexuality, the so-called gay gene. Alcoholics said there's an alcoholic gene, there's a genetic predisposition to becoming alcoholic. So genetics, in a much shrewder form than had been shown in the early days of eugenics, started making a comeback, also with potentially profound policy consequences. The nation was riven by a bitter debate over affirmative action. This was the policy growing out of the Civil Rights Acts of the Johnson years, saying that from now, the Civil Rights Act said that it was illegal to discriminate on the basis of race. But very quickly, the enforcement mechanisms had said, actually, we are going to discriminate on grounds of race, but in a benign way rather than in a hostile way. In other words, we're going to look with particular favour upon minorities who until now were discriminated against. Well, a succession of tests at the Supreme Court had challenged affirmative action because it substituted a group rights principle for an individual rights principle, which until then had been one of the had been sacrosanct in American jurisprudence. The Supreme Court itself in the 90s began to interpret the laws in a more conservative way, and it was in a way more skeptical of affirmative action. In the case Adirond versus Pena in 1995, the Supreme Court said only a specific compelling state interest could justify affirmative action. And from that time onwards, through a combination of Supreme Court decisions and voter referendums, affirmative action programs began to be rolled back. The African-American population was split between a thriving middle class, whose members had obviously benefited from affirmative action programs, and a big, demoralized underclass in the inner cities among America's very, very poorest people. When Charles Murray was writing Losing Ground and The Bell Curve, he was talking largely about the black population, which is one of the reasons why racial factors made these his claims so controversial. There was large-scale urban rioting in predominantly black neighborhoods, particularly after the Rodney King verdict in 1992. A black man had been beaten by a group of policemen who were then exonerated by a white jury. And that suggested continuing profound racial divisions, as did the O.J. Simpson trial in 1994-5. A famous ex-professional footballer was accused of murdering his ex-wife, and the evidence supporting his conviction seemed very strong, and yet a predominantly black jury exonerated him, which led to great rejoicing in the black community. Further signs of a split down racial lines in America of a very worrying kind. In the 90s, American crime and imprisonment rates remained far higher than in most of the rest of the industrial world. 10 million violent crimes were reported in 1992, which means presumably that more than that were actually committed. In 1994, for the first time, the American prison population exceeded 1 million people. And less than one criminal went to prison for each 100 reported crimes. It's easy to see why state governors under those circumstances and mayors of big cities could be talking about an epidemic of crime. America's dependence on the death penalty made it very unpopular among human rights groups. And again, America was one of the very few Western industrial democracies which still carried out the death penalty, although clearly it was supported by a majority of the voters. In other words, the Democratic policy, ironically, would be the death penalty. The 90s was also a period of culture wars. The belief on the part of many intellectuals that vital points of difference were sundering the entire nation. Books like Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind and E.D. Hirsch's Cultural Literacy said there's a crisis of legitimacy in the defense of Western civilization itself. America's the leader of this civilization, and it's got to take care of it. And yet it's threatened now by the advocates of multiculturalism, who take the view that one society and one culture is as good as another, and that we ought not to make any kind of invidious comparisons between them. People like Bloom and Hirsch were horrified by what they saw as the assault on the dead white males. There was the tradition of honouring the great literature of the past. The Al-Qaeda attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September the 11th, 2001, emphasised the world's continuing instability. Just as there was a vast gap between the rich and the poor inside the United States, so there was a vast gap between the world's richest and poorest nations, with many people elsewhere in the world alternately envying and loathing everything America represented. The hijackers' attack took advantage of America's open society, of its porous immigration system, and of its high technology. And the hijackers' careful planning on the one hand, and their incredible dedication on the other, their willingness to die in the attack, made it very, very difficult for it to have been foreseen and prevented. Almost at once, conspiracy theories began to proliferate that President Bush had known the attack was going to happen and could have prevented it but decided not to for sinister reasons. I think that's very unlikely, just as it's unlikely that President Roosevelt could have foreseen Pearl Harbor and decided to let it happen. It's easy to put together clues from the intelligence services after the fact, but would have been very difficult beforehand. Now, President George W. Bush, and his cabinet drew the conclusion that America must take a more proactive approach to foreign policy,
That's why they attacked Afghanistan to oust the Taliban, the regime which defended al-Qaeda. The Americans' rapid military success there stood in striking contrast to the agonizing 10-year campaign that had contributed to bringing down the Soviet Union in the 1980s. But the Americans' victory in Afghanistan was ambiguous because it wasn't clear that al-Qaeda's leaders, particularly Osama bin Laden, had actually been killed or the terrorist network destroyed. They may have simply moved on to other sympathetic states. And it proved very difficult for the Americans to create a stable alternative regime for Afghanistan after decades of war and political fragmentation. In the opening months of 2003, President Bush decided to attack Iraq, claiming that it was preparing weapons of mass destruction for use against America. Now, throughout the whole Cold War period, from the 1940s to the 1980s, the main point had always been to prepare for retaliation, but not to strike first. Now, the new wisdom was that it was wise to strike first, rather than wait for another potentially catastrophic assault. In justification of the war was Iraq's consistent failure to cooperate with 10 years of United Nations resolutions and Saddam Hussein's human rights abuses. But against the idea of the war was the danger of being sucked into a Vietnam-like quagmire, of arousing even more passionate anti-Americanism in the Arab world, and of being unable to create a stable political alternative to Saddam Hussein's despotism. That's why most of America's allies, apart from Great Britain, refused to cooperate. Nevertheless, the war began in March 2003 and marked another overwhelming American military success, almost a near annihilation of the enemy in 4 weeks, with scarcely 100 American casualties. But as in Afghanistan, a more ambiguous aftermath followed as the Americans sought the basis for a stable, democratic regime among people with sharp ethnic and religious antagonisms and no tradition of humane and peaceful self-government. The painful and divisive events of 2001 to 2003 demonstrated that, although America had overwhelming military power at its disposal, it could not look forward to presiding over a harmonious world and could not enjoy domestic consensus about its proper role in the world.